So I'd like to welcome you to the 2010 Annual Forum of the ASPH Pfizer Public Health Academy of Distinguished Teachers. My name is Lisa Sullivan. I'm the Associate Dean for Education at the Boston University School of Public Health and the Chair of Biostatistics there. It's my pleasure to introduce Mark Robson, who's the 2009 winner of the Academy Teaching Award. I'll tell you a little bit about the Academy. It seeks to evaluate the excellence, visibility, scholarship, and impact of learning and teaching in public health. It achieves these by publicly honoring faculty who excel in learning, teaching, and student mentoring, by sharing and disseminating discoveries in learning and instructional scholarship and experience, and by providing opportunities and resources to promote the role of teaching and learning among public health colleagues, programs, and schools. And so I'd like to tell you a little bit about Mark. He was the winner, as I said, of the 2009 award. He is the Dean of Agricultural and Urban Programs and Professor of Entomology at Rutgers University School of Environmental and Biological Sciences and Professor of Environmental and Occupational Health at the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey School of Public Health. He holds a bachelor's in agricultural science, a master's and a PhD in plant science. He also has an MPH in environmental and occupational health. Dr. Robson's research focus is on exposures to pesticides, including children, residential, and agricultural exposures. He's a contributing editor for Public Health Reports and on the editorial boards for the International Journal of Occupational and Environmental Health and Journal of Environmental Health and New Solutions, a Journal of Environmental and Occupational Health Policy. Dr. Robson and Dr. William Toscano are the editors of the textbook Environmental Health Risk Assessment for Public Health. If you don't mind, I'd just like to say a few words that came through in Mark's nomination a year ago, which resulted in his winning the 2009 award. For three decades, Mark Robson has been teaching environmental health. He has positively impacted the lives of hundreds of students. He was the first School of Public Health faculty member inducted to UMDNJ Master Educators Guild, a distinguished group of faculty recognized for excellence and dedication to teaching. The first School of Public Health faculty member to receive the Foundation of UMDNJ Excellence in Teaching Award in 2001 and 2006 Student Government Excellence in Teaching Award. He consistently receives positive evaluations for teaching and continuing education courses. And I'm sure you'll agree with those comments as soon as you hear from him. So it's my pleasure to introduce Mark Robson to this session, and he's going to speak to us about challenges and opportunities in global environmental health.
Well, good afternoon, and how wonderful it is to have the opportunity to make a presentation at our Academy of Distinguished Teachers in Public Health. As you know, when you get a teaching award, it's really never about you. It's about the students that you teach, and the metric we use is their success. So it's as all of us know who teach in public health, that's the great joy of public health. It's not what you do, but what your students do and what you learn from them. The great second century rabbi Judah the Prince once said that he learned much from his teachers, more from his students, more from his friends, but the most from his students. And I think that's really the joy of public health, is the opportunity to continue to learn. And so I appreciate Pfizer's and ASPH's support of this award. And like Dr. Sullivan, we're all very grateful to them for recognizing excellence in public health and excellence in public health teaching. And I also recognize that there are several people in the room that could give this talk much better than I can. So let's begin a little bit and talk about what we're going to do today. We're going to discuss some of the challenges and opportunities in global health with some case studies and examples. And we're going to sort of run around the world in the 45 minutes that we have. We're going to make the case because, as you know, in 2006, the World Health Organization determined that 27% of the global disease was caused by environmental exposures, which can actually be averted. We know that we can avert these through education, training, and carefully targeted interventions that can prevent a lot of this environmental risk. WHO also estimates that about 33% of the diseases in children under age 5 are caused by environmental exposures. So with this in mind, we can really influence and save about 4 million lives a year in developing countries. So how do we do this? Well, we do this by teaching. and that's what we do, of course, in public health. We are teachers. We're great borrowers, by the way. A lot of us don't do anything original. I have never had an original thought, but I'm one of the great borrowers of all time. And one of the things that we were able to do a few years ago was develop an NIEHS NIH Fogarty Center. And so a lot of the work that I share with you today is going to be based on the work of our Fogarty International Training and Environmental Occupational Health Center. Ours is in Bangkok, Thailand, but there are 16, and most of them are scattered around the world and are supported by schools of public health. And so whether it's our students graduating in New Jersey or our wonderful students in Thailand, these are the way that we go ahead and influence and improve environmental health around the globe. And sometimes you not only graduate bright students, but you find places for them to teach. And this is one of my PhD students from years ago, Dr. Wattasit Sirawong. And Wattasit has become the first environmental occupational health science faculty member in the College of Public Health Science at Chulalongkorn in Bangkok. So, you know, if you go long enough and you do it right, you can sort of plant them all over the world. And that's what we've tried to do. Another part of the way to influence this, of course, is to have workshops, not just for the teachers, not just for the students, but for people in ministries of health and ministries of environment and other people in government. And then finally, where what we do so well in public health is take what we've learned and do translational research and put it into practice. In this particular case, take the information that we've learned on environmental health and agriculture and start to train farmers. The focus of our environmental occupational training grant is on agricultural health and rural health. I'm a pesticide toxicologist by training. So let's look at some examples. And some of them, of course, come from farming examples. Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, of rubber, and of shrimp. So the next time that you go to the supermarket, if you eat shrimp, look at the box, and it probably came from Thailand. About 65% of the people in the country are still involved in agriculture. And what we've tried to do, of course, is look at the way that people make these pesticide applications. The developing world is so heavily reliant on agriculture and so heavily reliant on increasing production. But with this production comes a pretty heavy cost. And one of the things that we've tried very hard to do is to work with the multinational companies that sell the agricultural products to these developing countries and talk to them about stewardship. We recognize that increases in yields are necessary, and one way to bring them about is, of course, increases in the use of agricultural chemicals, but they have to be thoughtful, responsible, and necessary. We also spend quite a bit of time trying to engage people in integrated pest management and better management skills to sort of compensate and reduce the use of some of these chemicals. And I like this set of pictures because you see a shot that we actually took in a study that we're doing, but we also went back to the kids in the community, and these rural communities. The kids are as involved, as you'll see in a few minutes, as the parents are in the agricultural activities. And we ask the kids to talk about what happens in the field and try to start with them. Maybe the next generation we can reduce. And those three pictures are actually from 6 and 7 year olds. Remarkable artwork for a 6 or 7 year old. Certainly a lot more capable at 6 or 7 than I am at 56. One of the challenges we have is to look at how people apply these things and what they think their risks are. And so a few years ago, I had the opportunity to chair the EPA peer review for our National Agricultural Health Study in the United States. So I took the questionnaires, they're public domain, and my original idea was to go ahead and use those questionnaires in Thailand so that we'd have something to compare with what happens in the United States. That didn't quite work. But I did appreciate what our students came up with for their questionnaires, and they're translated back in English for you and I. Of course, what kind of protective clothing did you use? None. That's a fairly common answer in the United States, too. Chemical protective mask, and then we get down to number 4 where things start to fall apart. Knitting faces hat, you'll see that one in a moment. And my all-time favorite in my 35 years of doing this, loincloth. So it's kind of interesting what people perceive as protective clothing. And here's a person that was in a study that we started to do, and he's basically wearing a ski mask. And in his mind, this cotton shirt, short sleeve pants, and a ski mask are in fact protecting him from any kind of chemical exposure. The same is true here. This is up in the northern part of Thailand. The person is spraying tangerines, very potent organophosphorus insecticide, cotton clothes, but he wore them all week. He didn't wash them. So how do you influence that? Well, the challenge, of course, is to take the information, to get the academic people. You know, one of the things that I think we do pretty well in the United States is you and I, as public health professionals, really do go out into the field. You know, the epidemiologists always talk about shoe leather epidemiology. And in fact, that's true, and we give them a lot of credit for that. But the rest of us do a little bit of that, too. And so we took our show on the road, and this is a group of farmers that we were training, and we had a 2-week short course. We called it a body mapping short course. And at the end, we had a graduation. I was the graduation speaker. If you're from 10,000 miles away, you're always asked to speak. Unfortunately, my Thai is poor. It's getting a little bit better. So, and by the way, if you've ever had to have simultaneous translation, you know it doesn't take twice as long. It takes about 4 times as long to do it. But we brought our farmers into a rural health clinic in their own community where they'd be more comfortable and had them map out what goes on their farm and draw a picture of their farm and take the things that they had available in that clinic to sort of reconstruct or diagram their farm. This is my favorite picture because if you look over on the side, somehow in this picture a large elephant appeared. And I visited that farm and I didn't see any elephants, but I guess they took a little poetic license. One of the things that you have to do is make the research relevant, and you know that. In public health, that's what separates us from so many other disciplines, is we try very hard to take what we know and make it relevant. And so a few years ago, we started a series of studies on what are in these irrigation canals. These irrigation canals were constructed about 150 years ago by Rama V, the king, in the 1850s. And he recognized 150 years ago that Bangkok was becoming a very large city and there should be a viable agriculture right on the outskirts of the city to support the population. And so all these irrigation canals were dug by hand. And they have served for 150 years this community of folks. But what we've learned is that over time, this community of folks also have some significant risks. They have risks to chlorinated pesticides that they have in the canals, because in addition to growing rice, they also catch the fish. And so we started to do some risk assessments. One of the things that I try to do is environmental risk assessment. And in the absence of any data, we use default data. And some of you that do this know that the default data is useful, it's representative, but it's certainly not always appropriate. For instance, the US EPA says that the average white male in the United States weighs 70 kilograms. That's 159 pounds. The last time I weighed 159 was in the third grade. At the same time, my Thai students weigh about 40 kilograms. When I gave a lecture one time and we were talking about appropriate numbers, one of the kids asked me how many kilograms I weighed, and I told him I weighed about 130. And he said, oh, I weigh 40, you're 3 of me. And I guess that's one way to put it in perspective. So we went back out and we started to ask the farmers, and we were able to publish this data because we got direct measurements. We asked them how they caught the fish. You know, it's great to sort of assume it, but you actually have to go out and see the practice. And then finally, most importantly, we got some accurate dietary data. As somebody who's perpetually on a diet, I lie to myself all the time about serving size. And it's kind of humbling as you go through the expo. There are at least 4 or 5 displays where they have all these wonderful graphics that you can use if you're into community health and nutrition with portion size, and none of them match the portion size at my house. So we were able to get some accurate data and publish this, and it was pretty good work. We also looked at things like non-occupational exposure, and we looked at kids. And it's interesting because in rural communities, the kids are right with mom and dad all day long. And as you can see, in some cases, there's very little to protect from exposure. This little guy is 3. He was the fattest little kid we've ever had in a study, but he's adorable. But kids are right with mom and dad until they go off to school. And we were able to do a pretty interesting little study looking at what they're exposed to in this case, chlorinated or organophosphate insecticides, and we measured them during the wet and the dry season. We measured kids on the farms, and we had a group of reference kids that were in a little community that had nothing to do with agriculture. And as you can see, the lighter gray area, the pesticide exposure based on creatinine-adjusted urine samples for dialkyl phosphate is quite high in the kids that were on the farm. We also did it during the wet season or rainy season when less agriculture takes place and less applications, and thankfully the data support the fact that there was less applied and we found less in the kids. We get to be innovative sometimes. That's the fun part. The challenge and opportunity is that sometimes in places that you work there are opportunities that you don't necessarily have at home. Those of you that do environmental assessment in kids in the United States know that for a long time we washed hands with isopropyl alcohol to look at lead and other toxins that you might have in an urban setting, in a home, in a playground, or in agriculture. Well, these little folks don't wear shoes until they go off to kindergarten. And then, of course, in the true Thai custom, when you get to school, you take your shoes off when you go inside the classroom. So we were able to do, in addition to hand wipes, foot wipes. There's lots of data that describes hand wipes and how you can relate that data back to exposure. The data for foot wipes is a little more challenging, but we've been trying to go ahead and sort that data out. The talk is about challenges and opportunities. One of the challenges is when you work in a place like Thailand during the rainy season is that you spend a significant amount of time moving the university vehicle out of the mud. And so, as you can see, this is truly a challenge. What makes it different coming from New Jersey, I was intrigued that when we got stuck, people just stopped, jumped off their motorbike, and helped you. Now, at least in New Jersey, I can't speak for the other 49 states, but I can assure you that people go by, blow the horn, and maybe even say something that wouldn't be too polite, but they certainly wouldn't get out and give you a shoulder to do that. You have to think about, when you do this kind of work, how people perceive what their risk is. You can't be judgmental, you can't be overly critical, you have to be honest, but you also have to have the perspective of the individual applying the pesticide. This is a picture taken in West Africa, in Ghana, and this fellow is applying a very potent organophosphate insecticide, azofosmethyl. And this is the second farm we visited. The first farm we visited, I had a graduate student who was at Rutgers and UMD, and she went back to work at the School of Public Health in Accra, Ghana. And so when I came to visit, she took me out to some farms. And the first fellow had on nothing but a sprayer and a smile. Nothing but a sprayer and a smile. It's very hard to have a conversation with someone that you're not related to when they're naked. And so I said to them, I can't help but notice that you're not wearing any clothes. And he said, no, professor. He was very thoughtful. No, professor, I'm not. He says, you know, the pesticides are very hard on the clothing. So he takes them off and puts them off on the side of the field, makes the pesticide application, and then he takes some soap and water. There's always some water around little springs and things. And I guess he understands the idea of alkaline hydrolysis and washes himself well with soap and water, puts back on his clothes, and goes back into the village. So I didn't take that picture as much as I wanted to. You know, in environmental health, we love to take pictures. But I didn't take the picture. But the second fellow I did, and you can see he has a short sleeve shirt on, cotton pants, and no shoes, and he made the application. And then we stopped and we talked about it. He also washed carefully with soap and water. And in his mind, his biggest risk was to protect his clothing, and his personal health really didn't matter too much. It got a little more complicated when I looked to see where he did his mixing and loading. Those of you that study environmental exposures know that at least in agricultural chemicals, the risk occurs when someone is actually making the application. And what's interesting in this picture is this is the community water supply for this village. And you can see the ladies are coming. It's about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It's a very common scene that you see in rural parts of West Africa. And if you look carefully at the picture, mom is here with a little one. Okay, that's the traditional way that African ladies carry babies. It's a very efficient way, by the way. Babies burp, and they're not colicky, and they're very content, and they fall asleep very quickly. But the fellow is mixing and loading the pesticide as all these ladies are coming for water for domestic use that evening in their home. A little tricky. And then making the application, if this was the United States, we would tell him, of course, that he'd have to have a Tyvek suit on, rubber gloves, a protective mask, and an eye protection. And instead, he's just pouring the pesticide. So, in my world, of course, I've been studying for about 30 years now pesticide exposures and the health of people in agricultural communities, whether in the U.S. or in other places. And the one thing that I've learned the hard way is that while I think this is the most important thing to worry about, obviously there are competing risks. And some examples of competing risks in rural Thailand, where we're studying the pesticide applicators, we kind of get trumped by the concern associated with arsenic, naturally occurring arsenic in shallow wells. And so this is a village, and if you look at the pictures, bless you, if you look at the pictures, the red dots are arsenic levels over 200. Okay, the standard in the United States, by the way, is 3. Some of these wells actually go up to 800. And the yellow dots, they're less than 200, but not much less. And the blue dots, there aren't any wells in that home, so they obviously get the water from the next person. So these are incredibly high arsenic levels. A lot of good work has been done in schools of public health. Dr. Alan Smith in California, Dr. Cristiani in Harvard, and Dr. Joe Graziano at Columbia have all done some incredible work in different parts of the world to look at arsenic exposure and some of the impacts, and they're pretty dramatic, from the initial pigmentation changes on skin and Bowen's disease to more critical things like arsenical keratosis, and then finally basal or squamous cell carcinoma. And this is dramatic. If you look in this one province, the dark red in the slide means that 30% of the people in that village in this province had lesions like the last slide I showed you. So very dramatic. And in public health, you know, it's one thing to study these things and to measure them, but that's not what we're about in public health. The challenge in public health, of course, is not to just study them. The challenge is to fix them. And how the hell do you fix some of these things? They're not easy. This is naturally occurring. I once did a consultation for our US EPA, and it was about a naturally occurring product, and they were beside themselves. I'm not picking on EPA. I've trained a lot of people that work there, but they had no responsible party. You know, I said, who are you going to send a citation to? The Almighty? I mean, you have to have someone responsible, or you have to have a way to remedy this. And what was the way to remedy this was really kind of neat. In the end, it's deep wells. Deep wells don't have the arsenic content that shallow wells do. And so deep wells and piped water went ahead, and we were able to, the Japanese government supplied the money for the wells and the piping, because rural Thailand communities are quite poor. And we did a study with Prince of Songkla University in the southern part of Thailand to go ahead and to measure arsenic exposures post the implementation of these new deep wells. And the arsenic levels were negligible. And it was wonderful, because now these young people had a real opportunity to go ahead and bathe in clean water, to drink clean water, to clean their house in clean water. Rural Thai people are just fastidious about personal hygiene. It's not uncommon for them to bathe 3 and 4 times a day. And so again, you know, when you do a time activity pattern, the opportunity for exposure is quite great, because people are bathing 3 and 4 times a day. Sometimes the challenge is not naturally occurring, but it's still almost impossible to remediate. And this is a smelter up in Transylvania, in Romania. You know, Transylvania, of course, is famous for Dracula. It's also famous, unfortunately, for lots of environmental challenges. And so this is Copșa Mică. And up in Copșa Mică, this smelter has been operating since 1935. They've actually smelted and refined metals there for almost 2 centuries. But this particular operation since the 30s, the soil levels of lead are 4,000 parts per million. The blood lead levels in the kids on average in the community are 59, with quite a large range. And so these two beautiful little kids were in a project that a friend of mine who's a pediatrician there, I was invited to come just to observe and to offer some suggestions, and I was very short on suggestions when I left. We've done some pretty neat work in New Jersey. Dr. George Rhodes, our dean, and others have looked at dust and the dust content in homes, and if you can reduce the dust, you can reduce the lead, and it's, you know, statistically reduce the lead in kids. But this is a place where everywhere has lead. And the flip side is, when you go into the house, mom is a meticulous housekeeper. So the floors were dry mopped and wet mopped, the rugs were beaten, there weren't a lot of opportunities for us to reduce dust and lead inside. But outside, it was there, and it was there all the time. This lead smelter, this metal smelter that produces all the lead, employs 2,100 of the 5,000 people in the community. If you stopped the smelter today, it would be generations before you'd see any improvement. And so I guess word gets around when a stranger comes into town, especially a fat one with a Rutgers cap and 2 digital cameras. And so the mayor came out to meet me. I didn't know I was going to meet him. His English is quite good, by the way. And his first question was, Dr. Robson, why are you here? So I rambled on about why I was here. And he goes, are you going to recommend that we shut down this smelter? I said, absolutely not. I'm just here at the invitation of my colleague, who is a pediatrician, just to look and see if there are any suggestions we can make. He goes, this is the only employment for the 5,000 people that live in this community. We had another factory. It made carbon black, and we closed that. So those of you environmental health scientists know you finally can find something worse than this level of lead, a carbon black factory. And so that was closed. And so from the mayor's perspective, and rightly so, the trade-off, the risk-benefit side of the equation, of course, was that if you eliminated the smelter, you would have 100% unemployment now, instead of just the unemployment that resulted from the first factory going out. What's interesting is when you look at these kids, they look very healthy. They are very well behaved. All the things that you and I were taught in public health about high lead levels. First of all, imagine if you had lead levels like this here. The first thing that you would do is you would take them into the hospital and you start the chelation therapy. These little kids were very well behaved, very gracious and thoughtful. Talk to the school teachers and you find out that every kid is like this. Because this is a generational thing, people have learned to adapt to these high blood lead levels and survive. And so it's just a remarkable thing to see. And after you get over the initial shock of looking at the lead, you sort of walk around town and see this ain't the only problem in town. Shallow wells, this time, this well, we measured it that particular day, had over 100 parts per million of nitrate. 100 parts per million of nitrate. And then, of course, you go into the store, and what do you see? Well, what have we done for these folks? Well, we've sent them our cigarettes. And it says, enjoy the pleasure, if you translate the Romanian. And they're all brands that we recognize, unfortunately. I have a colleague who is a cardiologist in the Czech Republic, and he and I were having dinner one night on the veranda, this wonderful meal, and the whole time he's blowing smoke in my face. So I politely suggested that he might want to stop that. And I said, Thomas, I'm a bit surprised, since you're a cardiologist, that you smoke. And he obviously was a heavy smoker. I ate a lot. He smoked through most of the meal. And with a very serious face, he said, for 40 years, I had to smoke Russian cigarettes. Now I smoke Marlboro. And I said, well, hell, don't that beat all. We've really moved up. So the brands that are being sold are the brands that you and I recognize. The cigarettes that aren't being sold here are being sold around other parts of the world. When you go to other parts of the world, too, and look at global health, as many of you have, you recognize that problems that are very distant in our memory, or for those younger people in the room today, which most all of you are younger than me, that's very disappointing, is the things like polio eradication programs. Those aren't programs that we've had to have in this country for a very long time, but they're still enormous, especially in places like the former Soviet-controlled countries in Eastern Europe. But the bottom line, wherever you go in looking at global health, is poverty and people who are really not part of the mainstream and disenfranchised. These are Roma children. The more common word is gypsy. It's a little bit offensive, but Roma are gypsy kids. And I was stunned when I saw this little girl who was 6 and didn't have any clothes because it was not a hot day. And as I looked more carefully, I saw her 12-year-old sibling and was very distracted and first thought it was a distended abdomen from probably malnutrition, till I talked to the pediatrician who was my guide and said, no, that little 12-year-old girl was pregnant. She was receiving no prenatal care. She probably wouldn't have any help in delivery. And imagine a 12-year-old trying to deliver, and certainly no postnatal care. In that particular culture, it's not uncommon for young women, young girls, in this case not young women, young girls, to be abused by older men who don't have to take any responsibility for this. And what's remarkable is that while there's great efforts to improve the quality of life and education and everything else in these communities, that counts for everybody except, in this case, the Roma people. There's sort of a startling statistic that shows that over half of the millions and millions of Roma kids in Eastern Europe don't even complete primary school, and there's no effort to include them. So wherever you go in the world, if you're poor, as you know, you've been dealt a very bad hand. This is one of my favorite little signs, and I figured at this point you're about to fall asleep, and that's being verified by that last row in the back. I've been watching you. Please wake up. I'll feel better. I love this sign. I did a little consult a few years ago in Ghana, and my driver came and picked me up every morning. Every morning we went out in the field to do work, and we went past this sign. And so I said, where are the baboons? Oh, professor, it is too early. That's all right, next day. Where are the baboons? It's too hot. I said, you have no baboons. But every day for 2 weeks, I stopped to look for baboons. It was too hot, it was too cold, it was too late. But they have these signs. They don't have baboons. Disappointing to me, because I was dying to take some pictures. But back to something more serious, to talk about context, to talk about relevance. This is the community water supply up in Kumase, which is about 160 miles outside of Accra, the capital city. This is the second largest city in Ghana. And outside of this, in a rural area, you can see the community water supply where kids are bathing and playing and peeing and doing everything else. And mom is getting water for domestic use to cook. And you see ladies are washing clothes. It is the community water supply. I have learned in my 30 years of doing international health to say I am not thirsty in over 20 different languages, because it really is a serious issue. But I put this picture in not to just tell that little story, but to talk about how important it is for relevance when we do things in public health. So on that visit, I was invited to talk about risk assessment at the university. And it was a very nice conference, and many people were invited. And my given topic was one in a million risk, which, as you know, some of you know who do this like I do, this is the standard that we have in the United States. Or we call it de minimis risk or negligible risk. So off I went to give my presentation. And when I was invited, I politely suggested to the organizers there are probably a dozen other things I could talk about that might be more relevant. And I was surprised by the response I got. And the response I got was, why do you think our risk standards should be different than the rest of the world? Even though we're a developing country, we have every right to have a risk standard like you do in the developed world. And I said, you're absolutely right. And I proceeded to give an hour-long presentation about one in a million risk. And as I was giving the presentation and coming towards the end, there was a young woman in the back who just continually just looked very uneasy. And as we got closer to the end of the talk, I mean, she was really uneasy. So the lights came up, and they said, are there any questions? And her hand shot up very quickly. And so I said, yes, please. And she goes, thank you, Dr. Robson, for your very interesting and informative presentation. However, I am a pediatrician who practice in the north of the city. And where I practice, one in five children will die before they're 5 years of age from diarrheal disease, from lack of clean water. And one in five children will die of malaria because we can't control mosquitoes. Dr. Robson, that's two in five, or four in 10, or for you, 400,000 in a million. That's a risk number. Your number of one in a million is so irrelevant, so ridiculous, so inappropriate for West Africa that I'm really surprised that you came to make this presentation and sat down. So you smile and say, thank you for your very thoughtful and candid remarks. Where is the door? But she was absolutely right. And I politely suggested, but you know, you have to sort of stand up to these things and be candid. I said, I absolutely agree with you, doctor, and I appreciate the work that you do. And this was the topic I was assigned. And I don't disagree about the relevance of the topic. But it's important because we have these standards. In public health, we have these goals. And so this is a wonderful example of the organizers say, we should have the same standards the rest of the world does when we can get to them. And that's absolutely right. But when you present the information, you have to make sure that you present it in a way where people can look at it as a goal and look at it as relevant. And sure as hell, 400,000 in a million is a number that we all understand. I certainly don't understand one in a million risk, and I bet most of you don't either. Dr. Sullivan does because she's a biostatistician, and you know they're the people that gave us these numbers, so it's Lisa's fault. But seriously, that's a great challenge. When you do global health, is how do you take our message and make it relevant, appropriate, and respectful? How do you understand what's in other people's minds? This is a new well in a community. This is the mayor and a community leader, and I came to see the new well. Dr. Robson, come see our new well. They got aid money from a European institution and dug a new well. And very carefully I said, you know, Mr. Mayor, might it have been better to have placed the well away from the latrine? This is community housing, so a woman's latrine is on one side, the man's latrine is on the other, and you can see that how the waste leaves the latrine. I said, Mr. Mayor, might it not have been better to put the well somewhere else? And he looked at me straight-faced and goes, you just don't get it, do you? I said, you know, Mrs. Robson says that often. What do you mean by that? And he said, well, if I place the new well somewhere else, that's not the path the people travel. The people aren't going to use the new well. They're going to continue to use the old well. And I kind of thought of that great line that Willie Horton said to the FBI when he was arrested, when they said, Willie, why do you rob banks? And he said, because that's where the money is. And I think that's the model here. Where the people travel is where you have to have the new well. And so after the mayor started to explain his logic, it was actually very thoughtful and appropriate. He was a better public health person than me. His logic was that this well had a lifespan of about 3 years, and they dug it deeper than a previous well. And it would take about 3 years for the contamination to get to the water source, and in 3 years' time, he'd dig a new well. But if he put the well way over somewhere else, it wouldn't be used by the people. They continue to use the well that they knew was very seriously contaminated. So it's a little bit humbling, but it's a good public health lesson. Other public health lessons that you learn when you do this, the challenges part of this, is the message you give, the message that's received, and how you work with collaborators. We had a pretty interesting project funded by NIH under the Environmental Justice Program back in the 90s on the El Paso-Juarez border where Texas and Mexico come together. And the focus, again, was farm workers and their health and safety. And so we had some community meetings. We went a little deeper into Mexico, into Ejido Benito Juarez in Chihuahua. And ejidos are large sort of common areas, common land areas that are held, the government has them, but really they're held and controlled by local people. And so we were advertised as the local health folks were coming into town, and I was the gringo scientist, and I had a wonderful physician who was Mexican who was my partner in this. And we had a presentation. And people prepared, the promotores, the health promoting folks in the community worked very hard, and we had posters up about what kinds of problems are in the community and what the health concerns are, and one of the big health concerns was cervical cancer. And so I had a translator. My Spanish is poor, and when I'm on the clock, I desperately make sure that I don't say the wrong thing, because all of you know, especially those of you who are bilingual, know that for people that are really only monolingual, that you can accent the word the wrong way and really cause great problems. So through my translator, I was told that a person wanted to know, the focus again was an agricultural community and pesticides. They said, you know, there are lots and lots of cases of cervical cancer here. Dr. Robson, how does cervical cancer relate to agricultural exposures? And so I was sort of, you know, concerned about that question. And so I quietly covered the microphone and leaned over to my partner, Dr. Gomez, and said, Patrice, you're a woman, you're a physician, and you live here. You should answer the question. And she smiled and leaned back over and covered the microphone to me and said, I live here, and you're leaving on Tuesday. You answer the question. And so with the best I could, I talked about the real causes of cervical cancer and tried to relate it to how it works as far as people who are doing agricultural tasks and their lack of access to facilities and vaginal irritation, and you know, to say that there might be a slight possibility there. But it's very hard sometimes to give the message. And you'd be amazed, or maybe you wouldn't be amazed, if you find yourself in the same circumstances where the people that you work with, as she pointed out, you're leaving in a couple days. I live here. You have to answer the question. I wanted to close with a couple, and then we're going to have time for questions and your comments and your experiences, with just a few examples of things where it's a great challenge in environmental health, it's a great challenge in public health in general, and we can't control them because they really are acts of God. And the quick example I'm going to give you is the tsunami that took place 5 years ago. And I had competed for a Fulbright senior specialist in southern Thailand about a year before the tsunami took place, and I was to start in January. And as you know, at Christmas time, the tsunami took place in 2004 and just literally devastated the area of southern Thailand and lots of Southeast Asia. Thailand lost about 3,500 Thai citizens and about 1,600 tourists because it's such a popular tourist area that time of year. But the devastation was remarkable. This was a letter, email, that was sent to me by one of my Thai students. Ajahn is the Thai word for professor. It says, I'm fine, but we had a very bad experience for the tsunami crisis, and we passed the time because of our king. He is the best thing in our life. Again, it's a cultural thing. In Thailand, the king is viewed as sort of a semi-deity, and he's the longest reigning monarch in the world. As an aside, he was born in Cambridge Hospital in Boston. His father went to the Harvard Medical School. But the king is the person that sort of runs the show. And because of the strength the king showed for his people, the people got through it. And it's about a 97% Buddhist religion in the population. So that Buddhist mindset and the reverence for their monarch sort of got them through this disaster. And it says, you know, Pratip, the third year student, he went to the south and he worked as a volunteer. He carried and packed dead bodies for 2 days. He said it was the bad feeling for seeing so many dead persons, but he was proud that he helped them nakrap, which is sort of an affirmation in Thai. See you soon, Virus. And it was a remarkable thing to see. It was just not only the 3,600 people that died, but what it did long-term to the community. It's a coastal phenomenon, the tsunami in Thailand, and these are fishing villages. So the boats were destroyed. The high water mark, as you see in the house here, it just came in and just washed out everything in the village. They had these reclamation centers where they were able to rescue bodies, reclaim bodies, but they weren't able to identify them. And it was quite remarkable. There were four photos of each person. You know, when you watch SVU or CSI, of course, in the 30 or 60 minutes of the television program, they find the bad guy, they identify the body, the cause of death, and everybody moves on. It was taking about 3 and 4 days per person to try to identify the bodies that had been recovered. And that was really quite sobering. But there were some brighter moments in this devastation. And this is a little portable clinic. And the portable clinic, the Thai medical students went ahead and took the vitals and the history, and then the people went on to see the doctor. And so I was looking at this elderly gentleman who was there having his blood pressure taken and said to my medical student, who was my translator, gee, he looks pretty good. What's his complaint? And they said, well, 25 years ago, he was stepped on by his water buffalo and his arm was hurt. And this is the first time in that village that there's ever been a doctor. So there was free medical care, and he came to see the doctor. He wasn't impacted directly by the tsunami. It's remarkable sometimes to see how people have to sort of dig in and adapt to provide some service and medical care. This is a young physician from the University of California at Davis. He's an ER doc who volunteered 2 weeks of time. Next to him is the Thai medical student, the friend of the patient, and the patient. So a simple question like, how do you feel? 1, 2, 3, 4. My stomach hurts. 4, 3, 2, 1. It's just an exhausting process. It's sort of a cultural thing to take a friend with you when you go to the doctor or go for some sort of attention like that. Plus the translation. The physicians and nurses were totally spent at the end of the day just because of the language barrier. And in talking to the physician, he said, you know, this isn't so bad, because at this point, it was 6 or 8 days out, he was treating people with lots of GI disease because food had spoiled, and lots of skin infections because of lack of clean water. He really was, he could manage it. But a lot of people suffered severe psychological trauma. And so the psychiatrists and psychologists were exhausted because they weren't able to develop that rapport directly with the patient. They had to go through one or two intermediaries. The great challenge in all these things, of course, is the availability of water. And there were water supplies that were set up that were clean water, and then lots of spontaneous water supplies. This is a solvent used in the production of rubber. The warnings are in English and Malay, and Thai people in rural communities don't speak either. Once again, I asked for a drink of water and was directed to this container, which was a used solvent container. But hope does spring eternal. I went back a couple months later and was intrigued by how well people adapted and got back on their feet. Some money from a European aid organization, a person set up a laundry and put together this wonderful little laundry. They did all my laundry for 20 cents. And I'm still trying to figure out how to continue to send laundry to these people, because they did a really wonderful job. Look at the lady here. She's painting. And you say, well, she's painting. What's she doing? Well, she's actually making shirts that look like this, that were made on a sewing machine that didn't require any energy. It's all foot power. That temporary housing that was put up quickly in January, that we were so worried about heat stress and things for people, a few months later, had some greenery around it, people made it more personable, and they were able to manage this quite well. The last little part of this, before we break for discussion, is a place where it didn't have such a good outcome. About 250,000 people died in 15 seconds up in Sumatra and Aceh. The Thai people had a hit, the Indonesian people had an enormous hit. And you can see the area that was prior to, and then right after the tsunami. The tsunami took place on the December 26th in 2004. The large circled area is the very large prominent mosque in that region, and that was the only building to survive. What's interesting is that because of the topography, the water came in much further than it did in Thailand, and the salting that occurred in 2010, that soil is still not able to be farmed for food production because of the salt and other kinds of contamination that came in from the sea. In the background of all this devastation from the tsunami are the political tensions, which were new to me. You know, as a public health person, I'm willing to go almost anywhere armed with, you know, lots of Tylenol, lots of Imodium, and lots of Diet Coke. I'm going to go almost anywhere to try to help you if I can. But this was the time when I actually got a little more frightened, because the Aceh rebels, and some of us who are a little older remember when Indonesia was formed, the Acehese people had their own kingdom and they really didn't want to be part of Indonesia. So every day for decades, 25 to 35 people are killed in conflicts about the not wanting to be part of Indonesia. So in the background, as you travel around, you hear gunshots, you know, and they'll say, oh, don't worry, Professor, that's just people are shooting birds. No. It became really apparent when you went to the university. The university, in addition to the tsunami, there was also a 9.0 earthquake, and many buildings on the university were just leveled. Through some aid, again, through European, I think this was German support, they were able to build a new administration building. They dedicated the building in the morning. In the afternoon, the Aceh rebels burned it down because they felt that they had not gotten enough graft from the university, and they shot the rector of the university before the tsunami, and to demonstrate that they're still unhappy, they burned down the new building. It's a very difficult place to work. The physicians and nurses are very challenged. The hospitals are very challenged. The rector of the university refused to give graft to the rebels, and so he was murdered. He was also criticized by the military because he did give them some before he went ahead and drew the line, so he was sort of in a lose-lose. Our proposal was funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to build environmental capacity and work with nurses in rural communities, and there is an overabundance of physicians in Indonesia. There is a very, very serious shortage of nurses. And so we worked with the nursing school at Siakola University to try and give them some background on environmental issues and also send them to Thailand, in southern Thailand, at Princess Sungkhla University for nursing graduate education. And so this is a Moneska, our little mosque, where we had our community meetings. It's just sort of the focus of everything that happens in the community. And one of the things that was interesting when we surveyed the community and asked parents, well, what are some of their concerns? As a parent myself, I was quite intrigued by this. The parents said, well, our biggest concern, of course, are our teenagers. And they have a lot of idle time, and we're worried that they're going to get in a lot of trouble. And you could have that same discussion in Denver, in New Brunswick, New Jersey, in Stockholm, Sweden, anywhere in the world. And that was the same concern here. Even though the median income, US dollar equivalent, is about $30 a month, nutrition is still a huge problem. The amount of soda consumed is incredible, and the amount of dental problems in these beautiful little children is just enormous. Of course, there is no fluoridated water, and there are no precautions to sway people away from regular soda. So we had a series of workshops on the food pyramid, good old basic public health, how to get the best out of your food dollar, what to eat to be healthy. The thing that amazed me the most is in Indonesia is the cigarette advertising. It sort of trumped every place I've ever been, including in China, as far as who smokes. Even the elementary school soccer teams are sponsored by cigarette manufacturers. And so the communities are still recovering from the tsunami. It's taking a long time. We're hopeful that it'll make a difference. What do we do in public health? Well, you and I in public health try very hard to make a difference. We try to export the information that we know. We try to train young men and women who come here in the United States. We try to take that information out. Years ago, the great toxicologist, the father of toxicology, some of us like to say, Paracelsus, said it's the dose that makes the poison. And centuries later, Dr. Kirk Smith, University of California, said it's the place that makes the poison. And I think both Paracelsus and Dr. Smith are right, because it's the place that really provides the dose. Whether you have the 59 micrograms per deciliter blood lead in Romania, whether you have the 1 in 5 kids that die of malaria or diarrheal disease, whether you have the people who die every day because of conflict, it's about the place. So the opportunities are great in public health, and you and I should be proud of that and the opportunities that we have. The challenges are greater, and I am very grateful that you all stayed awake. And I'll turn up the lights and we'll take any questions. Thanks.